Well, now the subject this morning is the unlikely theme of science and the second coming. But as a matter of fact, it isn't so unlikely because if science gives insight in the light of Scripture to the beginning of the world, so does it also to the end of the world. As a matter of fact, we can only really understand fully the biblical teaching about the beginning in the light of the consummation, and vice versa. We need both. Many people have commented on the relationship between Genesis and Revelation, and the parallels and so on. And so there is quite a bit, I think, of instruction in the study of the physical world in the last days in the light of science. Now, we're not going to be dealing with prophecy in a spiritual sense, but rather as it relates to the physical cosmos, the earth, the atmosphere, the physical world. Now, you know that God had a purpose in creation. And the fact that we seem to be far away from Him today and that the world is going down into chaos, it seems, pollution and sin and decadence, does not mean that God is going to fail in His purpose. He had a purpose in creation. He's going to accomplish that purpose. He has allowed sin to intrude for a season with the curse and all that goes with it. But in the light of eternity, this is only a very temporary interruption, and it won't be allowed to continue much longer. The Lord has promised in many, many ways and places, as the Apostle Peter said, by the mouth of all His holy prophets, since the world began, the times of restoration of all things. And the Lord Jesus Christ also in Revelation 21:5 said, "Behold, I'm going to make all things new again." Everything is going to be made at least as new and perfect and good as it was in the beginning, and probably far better, but at least that good. God had a purpose in everything that He made in the first creation, and this purpose has not yet been accomplished, and so He's going to renew that first creation someday, restore all things, make all things new. Now, with this sort of a basic framework in mind, that the new earth is going to be the renewed old earth, and it will be the earth when He says a new heaven and a new earth, the earth is this planet. And that's all the earth is this planet. He's going to make it new again. It's going to be a new earth, and it's going to last forever. Now, with that in mind, I think that we can have a rather interesting hypothesis or model or framework of interpretation within which to study the development of the physical world, both past and future. The first earth was perfect. God said everything He had made was very good. In heaven and in earth, there was nothing out of order. Everything was perfect at the end of the 6 days of creation. But then, of course, something went wrong. Man sinned. By one man, sin entered into the world, it says, and death by sin. So death came into the world when sin came into the world. And since then, the whole creation is groaning and travailing together in pain until now, under this bondage of corruption or decay, the second law of thermodynamics we called it the other day. Cursed is the ground for thy sake, the very dust of the earth, the basic elements, the fundamental structure of the cosmos is brought under this curse of corruption, of decay, of disintegration. It's running down, it's going to confusion, disorder, heading downhill towards an ultimate death if it continues long enough that way. And so that was the condition in the world after the creation when the curse was pronounced. But for a while, of course, the basic aspect of the world didn't change much. It was the same geography, the same atmosphere, the same physical world that God had created, the only difference being that now it was under the curse of decay and death, which it had not been originally. But then there was another great interruption at the time of the flood. Might almost consider it a second curse. It seems to be referred to in those terms in the 8th chapter of Genesis, when God said, "I won't curse the earth anymore for man's sake." But at any rate, it was a great destruction, a great cataclysm, which completely changed the structure of the cosmos. As the Apostle Peter says, the cosmos that then was, being cataclysmed with water, perished. Not annihilated, but completely changed as a cosmos, as an ordered system. The atmosphere, the earth, the geography, the topography, the geology, the hydrology, everything changed. And the world as it emerged after the flood was vastly different from the antediluvian world before the flood. And we'll see some of those changes in just a moment. But then this world also is not going to go on forever. there's been sort of a downhill trend. The first earth, and then the cursed earth, and then the destroyed earth after the flood. Then there's going to be a great period of purgation just ahead of us. And in some measure, it's going to be restored to the condition of the millennial earth. But this millennial earth will still be under the curse. It will still be death. The second law of thermodynamics will still be in effect. And so it won't be perfect yet like it was in the beginning. So finally, there's going to be the renewed earth, which will then last forever, in which there will be no more curse. So there's sort of a valley, you see. The first earth, the antediluvian earth, the present earth, and then the millennial earth, and then the new earth. Now with this in mind, the new earth and the first earth are parallel, and there are many points of similarity. By the same token, the antediluvian earth and the millennial earth are parallel. There are many points of similarity. And we're down here in the valley between. Now, therefore, we can learn a great deal about the new earth from the study of the original earth and vice versa, and a great deal about the millennial earth from the study of the antediluvian earth and vice versa. Now, for a brief time then, let's look at the implications that we get from the description of the world as it came from the creative hand of God. He, first of all, called the earth and the heaven into existence. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And at that point in time, there was no matter in the world but the earth. The heaven is not the stars, because later it says they were the host of heaven. They were placed in the heaven. The heaven is just space. And so God created the space-mass-time continuum, which we call our universe, in his first act of creation, the basic elemental structure of the cosmos, space, mass, and time. Earth was mass, space was heaven, beginning was the time. And all had to be created as a functioning entity, of course, right from the start, since it is a continuum, each being part of the whole. Now, he proceeded then, of course, to cause the earth to be inhabited and to be structured. Initially, it was without form and void. That is, it had no structure. It was nothing wrong with it. It just wasn't complete. Perfection, of course, means completeness, and it wasn't complete until God said it was complete at the end of the 6 days, when he said the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the host of them. But it was initially without structure and without inhabitant. But as we read, and of course in Isaiah 45:18, God did not form the earth to be without form, or to be without inhabited. He formed it to be inhabited, and so the 6 days tell how he structured the created entities, and then brought inhabitants to the structured world. Now, the first act then, after the initial act of calling into existence the universe, was to introduce energy. God said, let there be light. The Spirit of God began to vibrate, and the waves began to flow out. The electromagnetic spectrum of energy began to flow forth to activate and to energize the world which he had created. Let there be light, and there was light. And God separated the light from the darkness, and the darkness he called night, the light he called day, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And incidentally, if you want to know what the word day means in Genesis 1, there it's defined the first time it's used. God called the light day. It was the daylight period, the light period in the succession of light and darkness as the earth began to move on its axis. Now the sun and the moon hadn't yet come into existence, but the light had. God could create, you see, the whole world functioning right from the start, like he made Adam a full-grown man. And he created the light emanations, not only at the same time, but even before he created the light sources. So there was light bathing the earth, and the earth was rotating on its axis, and there was a succession of day and night for the first 3 days, even though he had not yet created the source of the light, which was made on the fourth day, the sun and the moon and the stars. And then on the second day, it speaks of the waters being separated from the original deep into two great deeps, the waters above the firmament and the waters below the firmament. Firmament simply means expanse, or thinness, or stretched outness. And it's more or less synonymous with our term space. There can be space in general, and there can be particular spaces. There can be a firmament in which the birds fly, and there can be a firmament in which the heavens, or the stars and the sun shine. It's simply the space. And so he created a space between the waters above and below. And this is the atmosphere. And this tells us that there was a great body of water up above the atmosphere in the original creation. And I think this was very likely in the form of water vapor. Not liquid water, nor solid water, but water vapor. Now, you understand, of course, that clouds are not water vapor. They're liquid water droplets. Water vapor is invisible. And so this vapor this vapor blanket of water up above the atmosphere was invisible. The light from the sun and the moon and the stars could penetrate easily, and no one would know it was there, except for the effects it would produce, and it would produce very remarkable effects. A great blanket of vapor such as that would augment the present weak greenhouse effect, which the inch and a half of water vapor in the present atmosphere produces, so that there would be a much strengthened greenhouse effect, and the Earth would enjoy a marvelous, warm, pleasant, mild climate all around the world, from equator to pole. There would be no deserts, ice caps. And furthermore, the land surfaces were much more extensive because the waters of the present ocean came from this vapor blanket and up from the fountains of the deep at the time of the flood. So the initial body of small seas and rivers and so on, which were created for the first earth, were not nearly as extensive in width or in depth as the present oceans. And furthermore, the topography was much more gentle and pleasant. There were not the great rugged ranges like there are now, which have such a tremendous effect on the climate. But rather, there were small hills and mountains, nothing like the present world. So the topography was pleasant, the climate was mild, and everything was conducive to a tremendous growth of vegetation everywhere. It was a wonderful world. And the animals, of course, were created to be in fellowship with one another and with man. And it wasn't until later that they began to fight and to struggle for their existence and so on. Everything was perfect. As God said, everything that he had made was very good in the beginning. But then the curse came and the condition began to deteriorate. But, of course, there was nothing immediately to change the physical environment. And so this canopy of vapor was there, and the mild climate, warm climate was everywhere. This, of course, prevented the great atmospheric movements because they're caused by temperature differences from equator to pole and land to sea and plain to mountain and so on. And consequently, there could be no rain such as we know it. As it says in Genesis 2:5, God hadn't caused it to rain on the earth in those days. There was no rain. Only a daily mist went up, and there was a difference in temperature from night to day, slight difference. It caused a sort of a dew or ground fog effect. And then there were the artesian springs that came out of the waters beneath the firmament. The waters locked under pressure down in the below the fountains of the deep. And some of these came out to form artesian springs and then rivers which coursed out through the land to water the ground and to provide the source of the waters for the daily mist and so on. Well, it's a very different sort of a hydrologic cycle than we have in the present world, and we don't maybe understand all about it, but it seems to be that this is what the Bible indicates was the condition in the original created world. And another effect, of course, of this canopy was it would filter out the radiations from space, which are known to be harmful to living flesh. Both genetic mutations and somatic mutations are caused by the cosmic rays and the ultraviolet and so on that are not filtered out very efficiently now, but would be much more so by a more extensive blanket. And this would mean, therefore, that the aging process would be much slower than it now is, and consequently, men and animals both would live to much longer ages in that original world, even after death came in. Well, all that changed, of course, at the time of the flood. The canopy precipitated, the fountains of the deep burst open, there was a great upheaval on the structure of the earth just drastically changed. After the flood, it says in the 104th Psalm that the mountains rose up and the basin sank down. There were great rivers scoured out rapidly as the topography was readjusting, and a great earth movements took place. The ice age followed because of the change in climate at the polar regions, and many other residual effects of the great cataclysm continued for many, many centuries, and to some degree, I think, are still continuing today, because the earth is still in a condition of unstable equilibrium in a considerable degree. Well, now compare that with what we know about the millennial earth. We don't know everything about it, but we do know some things. For example, it says in the 40th chapter of Isaiah that in that millennial earth, the valleys are going to be exalted, and the mountains and hills are going to be brought low, and the crooked ways are going to be made straight, and the rough places are going to be made plain. The topography is going to be smoothed out again. That's in the 40th chapter of Isaiah. It says in the 35th chapter of Isaiah that the desert is going to blossom and rejoice like a rose, and there's going to be streams in the desert. Rivers are going to break out in the wilderness. So the deserts are going to be removed again, the ice caps. There are indications in the Psalms and the Book of Job in various places that the ice caps are going to be melted, and the earth is all going to be inhabitable again. And there's going to be lush vegetation again everywhere. And furthermore, it says in the 65th of Isaiah that there will be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. The child shall die 100 years old. The sinner being accursed shall die at 100 years. But evidently longevity is going to be restored. We read in the 20th chapter of Revelation about people living for the 1,000-year period there in the millennium. But there's still going to be death. It isn't going to be perfection, but it will be parallel, I think, in many respects, to the antediluvian world. And finally, the earth is going to be filled again with people, just like it was at the time. You remember it says in Genesis chapter 6, the men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and then it says, before very long, man had filled the earth with violence. And to fill it with violence, he had to first of all fill it with people. So there was a population explosion, and people covered the face of the earth. Well, once again, it says there are going to be men like the sand of the sea at the end of this 1,000-year period. But it also says that rather than the earth being filled with violence, it's going to be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea in those days. Going to be harmony between the man and the animals again. The wolf is going to lie down with the lamb, and the lion's going to eat straw like the bullock, and they'll not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. Well, now, how's this all going to come about? Of course, God could just speak and do it, but there does seem to be indication in the book of Revelation in particular, as well as in the Old Testament, that physical means are going to be used to accomplish this restoration. Now, as you know, I'm a naive literalist, and so I take Revelation literally, just like Genesis, and I don't know any other way to do it. I'm just not smart enough to figure out symbols and everything. It seems to me that God probably wrote the Bible for people such as I that think words mean what they say. And so when I read these things in the book of Revelation, I just have to take them to mean what they say, unless there's evidence in the context that some figure of speech is being used, and then, of course, that's different. Well, in the account of the tribulation period in the middle part of the book of Revelation, right at the center of that 7-year period, it says God's going to send two great witnesses. And they're going to prophesy for 3.5 years, whatever the number of days is. 3.5 years. Now, who these witnesses are, we could discuss. I think Enoch and Elijah, but I don't know. And anyway, there are two witnesses that God sends to sort of supervise the testimony of the Lord in those days when it's very difficult to be a witness for the Lord Jesus Christ. They're going to be the 144,000 and so on. But the two witnesses, and it says furthermore that they have power to shut up the heavens in the days of their prophecy. Just like Elijah back in the time when he was first on the earth, shut up the heavens for 3.5 years in the land of Israel. So now the scope of their testimony is worldwide, and they're going to shut up the heavens for 3.5 years over the whole world. And so there's going to be 3.5 years, I think the first half of the tribulation period, during the time of their witness, before they are martyred and taken up, and then the beast takes over for 3.5 years and so on. But at any rate, there's going to be 3.5 years where there's no rain on the earth. No rain anywhere, all over the world. Now, that's a remarkable thing to contemplate. But then not only that, but towards the middle part of that first half of the tribulation period, 7th chapter of Revelation, it says God speaks to the angels who have charge of the winds, that they keep the winds from blowing. So not only will there be no rain, but there won't be any wind. There are going to be other things happen. There are going to be volcanic activity. There are going to be earthquakes. In fact, it says in the 6th chapter of Revelation, there's going to be great earthquakes so that the islands and the mountains are moved out of their places. There's going to be tremendous upheaval as the earth. We know now something about the ring of plates, tectonic plates around the oceans, and how unstable the earth is, and how easily this could happen. There's going to be great earthquakes which are just going to move the mountains and the islands out of their places. And volcanic activity, there's going to be meteorite bombardments and all kinds of things that just make the sky dark. And in all of this, there's going to be no rain and no wind. And then a little later, it says that God speaks to another angel, and he pours out his bowl upon the sun. The angels apparently have power over natural processes in some degree. And here's a mighty angel who has power over the thermonuclear processes in the sun, and he heats up the sun so that it's hotter than it was before, and men are scorched with heat. Now here you have a picture of tremendous heat, and no wind, and no rain. The heat boils up the oceans and evaporates them, and there's no place the waters can go. It simply goes up, and gradually, the water in the oceans, which once was above the firmament, is restored up to where it was in the beginning. And at the same time, these great earth movements begin to take place, restoring the topography back again. And finally, to make the long story short, it says in the 18th chapter, I think it is, or maybe it's 16th of Revelation, that there's such a great earthquake at the termination of all, you see, the waters are boiling out of the oceans, and so that the isostatic adjustments are changing, and the balance of forces in the lands and the oceans is different, and there's no more hydrostatic support for the lands, and the coastlines begin to dissolve and to slip into the ocean. Down in San Diego, I tell the folks down there that either they better get saved or they better move out of California. Because sooner or later that's going to happen. It says in Isaiah 24 that the earth is clean dissolved exceedingly. The earth is utterly broken down. And finally it says back there that there's such a great earthquake that not only are the mountains and islands moved out of their places, but it says the mountains and islands can't even be found anymore. And then it will be fulfilled where it says that every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill brought low, and the rough places made plain and the crooked ways made straight. The topography is going to be smoothed out, the canopy is going to be restored, and the conditions, physically speaking, are going to be somewhat similar at least to what they were in the world before the flood. But of course, that's not the end. The millennium is not the end. We have the thousand-year period, but man is still a sinner, and he still has to be tested, and so the devil is going to be loose, and then he's going to go out and tempt men. He's going to gather a great number, and they'll be destroyed at the end of that period. But you see, we finally have to come to the place where the curse itself is removed, and the curse has affected the very structure of the elements. And so the elements are going to have to be dissolved to remove the curse. The earth and the heavens are going to have to flee away. The day of the Lord is going to come as a thief in the night, in which the elements being on fire shall be dissolved. The earth being on fire shall be, and the elements melt with fervent heat. All these things shall be burned up. There's going to be a great fire next time, like there was a great flood last time, to completely change the structure of the cosmos. It won't be annihilated, but it will be changed and renewed, and all the age-long effects of the second law and the curse and the fossils and all the other testimonies of death and suffering will be burned out, and it's going to be made new by the creative hand of God once again. And he says, I, John, saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. It's all going to be up there, I guess. And he says, I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared like a bride adorned for her husband. And here's this great city. And again, I just have to believe it's a literal city, and that it's this is not heaven. It's coming down out of heaven, you see. It's up there now. The Lord has gone to prepare a place for us. He's building this city that has foundations. It's going to come down and rest on the earth, the renewed earth. And he describes it. Four square, 1,400 miles long, 1,400 miles wide, 1,400 miles deep. And, of course, and we'll have renewed bodies then, too, and we won't be limited by electromagnetic and gravitational forces and all like we are now. And so we can move vertically as well as horizontally. You won't need elevators to get up to the 1,400-mile level in the city. You can just go there.